Obama faces the press one last time today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In his final news conference, President Obama explains why he commuted Chelsea Manning's prison sentence.
Let's be clear. Chelsea Manning has served a tough prison sentence.
Some think the president's done the right thing.
A lot of people see Chelsea Manning as a whistleblower. I do not. Some people see Chelsea Manning as a traitor. I do not.
Plus, a Latino White House staffer reflects on the Obama administration's diversity and preps for what's next.
Vacation. I'm really excited about it. I'm going to Hawaii. So I'm going to take a break and then perhaps a long nap, and we'll see what comes after that.
That's all today here on The World. Thanks for being with us. Two press conferences a week apart, two very different styles. I'm sure I don't have to remind you about President-elect Trump's session with reporters last week in New York. It was tense and included Trump disparaging two news organizations. Since then, his transition team has suggested that the new administration may not let reporters work inside the White House. Contrast that with President Obama's last White House press conference today. He complimented reporters for holding him accountable and being fair.
And having you in this building has made this place work better.
President Obama also answered questions about his decision to commute Chelsea Manning's sentence. Manning, you'll recall, was the Army private sentenced to 35 years in jail for leaking classified government documents. That was in 2010. Back then, Chelsea Manning was Bradley Manning. She has since said that she identifies as female, not male. Today, Obama described Manning's sentence as disproportionate and said he was comfortable that justice had been served.
Let's be clear. Chelsea Manning has served a tough prison sentence. So the notion that the average person who was thinking about disclosing vital classified information would think that it goes unpunished, I don't think would get that impression from the sentence that Chelsea Manning has served.
President Obama there speaking this afternoon at the White House. P.J. Crowley was the U.S. State Department spokesman when Manning was imprisoned. Crowley resigned after comments he made criticizing Manning's treatment angered White House officials. Today, Crowley still believes Manning was neither a whistleblower nor a traitor.
What she did was to compromise hundreds of thousands of sensitive and classified documents. She put real people and real interests at risk. By the same token, there's a lot of extenuating circumstances. You know, the military was ill-equipped to deal with a prisoner going through a gender transition. And I think on balance, the military has sent a very strong message to the military force. If you compromise classified information, there will be consequences. You know, by the same token, you know, what President Obama has done is showed some compassion to the unique circumstances of her case. And I think it's a fair result.
If you don't think Chelsea Manning is a whistleblower or a traitor, is there a word you would use to describe her?
Well, yeah, I think she was a naive and troubled soldier. Should probably never have been promoted out of basic training. Should certainly never have found herself in the middle of a war zone. Had the military done due diligence in terms of appropriate computer network security, she would not have been able to pass these documents to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
She did dump over a quarter million diplomatic cables, nearly half a million U.S. Army reports, and that video of the U.S. airstrike on Baghdad, killing maybe a dozen people, maybe more, that some said had a terrible effect on U.S. troops and morale. I mean, there was Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton who said, "When I was leading soldiers in Afghanistan, Private Manning was undermining us by leaking hundreds of thousands of classified documents." Won't this commutation of her sentence empower others who enter the military, get clearances, and then decide, no, this stuff I'm seeing is wrong, I'm going to blow the whistle?
That's why I disagreed with President Obama. Part of his rationale, you know, was in saying that he thought that the original sentence was too severe. I think the 35-year sentence sent a very strong message to the troops. If you do this, there will be consequences. You know, by the same token, we're emerging with a different social culture. We have a culture now to share information, not to stovepipe information.
So let's talk about Edward Snowden for a moment. Do you think this decision about commuting a Chelsea Manning sentence will have any bearing on the case of Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor?
That's part of the contrast between, you know, Chelsea Manning, who owned up to what she did, you know, faced a military court, received a severe sentence, has gone, been in custody for 7 years. And then we can debate whether, 7 years in custody appropriately fits what she did. Edward Snowden, rather than doing what he did and then, facing American justice, decided to flee first to Hong Kong and then to Moscow. So, his situation is different. He has not chosen to step up and take responsibility for what he has done. I think that that has a bearing. Now, going forward, if he can find a way back to the United States where he is willing to face the charges that that confront him, then we'll face the same situation of how do you send a strong signal that there will be consequences when you compromise classified information. While acknowledging that in the case of Edward Snowden, some of the revelations, not all of them, did help clarify what the government is doing to protect American citizens.
Russian officials, I don't know if you heard, they said today they'd granted Snowden 2 more years of temporary asylum. What do you expect to be in store for him? And do you think the timing of these 2 more years of asylum for Snowden is related to the Chelsea Manning news?
I think there have been some discussions between Snowden representatives and U.S. officials as to how a prospective prosecution, might unfold. But, Edward Snowden, somewhat like Julian Assange, is kind of stuck, in this alternate universe.
On a personal note, P.J. Crowley, you really went to the mat for Chelsea Manning. Just remind us what you said in Manning's defense that prompted your resignation and whether you'd do any of that differently.
As the Assistant Secretary of State, in a session at MIT, not far from your studios, I was asked a fair question. Why is the government abusing, if not torturing, Bradley Manning? At the time that we had that discussion, Chelsea Manning was in a military brig in Quantico. She was being harassed and mistreated by the prison officials. Her clothing was being taken away at night, for fear of a suicide watch. And I called that treatment ridiculous, counterproductive, and stupid. I stood by what I said and resigned, given the reaction of the president and the White House. But to this day, I stand by, what I said. I thought it was important. And the military transferred her from Quantico to Fort Leavenworth. When she came to trial, the trial was far more about what she did and far less about what the government did to her.
P.J. Crowley was a U.S. State Department spokesman from 2009 to 2011. Thanks very much for being with us.
Marco, a pleasure.
Another beneficiary of President Obama's clemency is at the opposite end of the military hierarchy of Private Manning. Marine James Cartwright rose to the rank of a 4-star general and served 2 terms as vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, retiring in 2011. Last October, he pled guilty to a federal felony charge of lying to the FBI. Yesterday, General Cartwright was pardoned by Obama. The charge was in connection to a leak of classified information relating to the Stuxnet computer virus and its use to attack Iran. That leaked information was used by New York Times reporter David Sanger in his book, Confront and Conceal.
I spent 14 months working on the story of how some nation state, turned out to be the United States and Israel together, had put together and used the most sophisticated cyber weapon ever seen and seen to this date against another country. It was an entirely new use of a new weapon and is the subject now of a documentary that some of your listeners may have seen called Zero Days. Mm. So at the very end of the process, after the book chapters were largely written and so forth, I did go to see General Cartwright, and as I indicated in a letter to the judge who was supposed to sentence him before the pardon, most of the discussion focused on his concerns about what elements of it we not publish so that we don't give away techniques that are useful to U.S. intelligence.
So the FBI charges aside, what do you believe Cartwright's role in the Stuxnet virus ending up in Iran actually was? What did he do?
Well, he was the creator of what became the United States Cyber Command. It was a subset of Strategic Command, which runs the nation's nuclear weapons, when he was running STRATCOM, and then helped promote greater use of cyber by the U.S. government, and particularly to begin to develop a class of cyber weapons, as American adversaries had. So when you read those sections of Confront and Conceal, or you read the Times' account of it, he was present at many of the meetings where they had to go make key decisions.
So the aim was to sabotage Iran's nuclear capabilities.
That's right. And it did. It set them back. People argue about for how long. My own reporting indicates that it was probably a year, maybe a year and a half. But this was one of those investigations that sprawled across many continents, many different sources. The Israelis were involved, the Germans were involved, the Brits were involved. So the whole idea, the premise that you would have gotten from reading the charging papers in the case, that one person, whether it was General Cartwright or anybody else, had been, you know, the sole source of this data was pretty silly. And in fact, by the time I even saw General Cartwright, we had most of the story together and written.
Yeah, so by your account, how central to the Stuxnet story was General Cartwright?
Well, he was certainly a central player in what went on in the Obama and before that President Bush efforts to go try to destabilize the Iranian program.
And as a source, how central was he?
You know, I would say that the most of the discussion, as I indicated to the court, really focused on the question of, which he wasn't the only one, of what details that we had gathered elsewhere that they were concerned if they became public. And so there were other sitting officials, at that time he was no longer sitting, who had actually been designated to go talk to me and authorized to go talk to me on the question of what we were going to publish and what their concerns were. I think his motives are very much what he said to the court when he pled, which was that he was seeking to make sure that if the story was getting out, that it didn't get out with details that would be harmful to the United States.
Obama,
so it's odd that he was sort of caught in the web of this whole investigation.
Obama really seemed to crack down on leaks and leakers. And the 2016 documentary about Stuxnet, Zero Days, that you were closely involved in, it's revealed that the feds put everyone in one NSA office on a polygraph, including interns, to get to the bottom of the leak. Were you surprised Obama has pardoned him?
You know, I think once I made the fascinating decision yesterday to also pardon Chelsea Manning, then it became all the more critical that he sort of look at the question of what happened to General Cartwright and whether or not he was being unfairly singled out in this particular case.
David Sanger with the New York Times, thank you very much.
Thank you.
President Obama has now commuted almost 1,400 sentences and pardoned more than 200 people. Sounds like a lot, but Obama is not the most forgiving president in history. Our data team is crunching the numbers on the history of presidential pardons and commutations. Check out what they found at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World.
And I'm Rupa Shenoy. The White House will be changing hands on Friday, and it's worth noting, it goes deeper than just who's sitting in the Oval Office. The demographics of the White House staff will also change. The Obama administration has been the most diverse in U.S. history, thanks to staffers like Gabriela Chokier.
It's just unbelievable to be sitting in a meeting and have that diversity be completely normal.
Chokier's job at the White House is senior director of Hispanic media. Her parents are from Argentina. She grew up in California, but visited Argentina every year to see her family. She worked at the State Department before joining the White House last year.
A couple weeks into this job, I had the unbelievable opportunity to travel with the president to Cuba, such a historic trip. And following Cuba, the whole trip continued on to Argentina, which is home for me. And it was really emotional to be in places that were so routine for me and part of my life growing up. I could not have been more proud to have my worlds unite. There had not been a president that visited Argentina, and I believe more than a dozen years. So to have a front row seat to that was just humbling.
Were your parents ever concerned that this job would consume you?
Well, I think my mom wished I got a little more sleep, but my mom had the opportunity to come recently to the White House and have a photo taken with me and the president in the Oval Office. And she said to the president, "In Argentina, we say hello with a kiss." And so the president said to her in Spanish, "Encantado," which means a pleasure, and gave her two kisses. And I don't think my mom has washed her cheeks yet. And just to take that moment in was overwhelming joy.
So years from now, what moments are you going to remember?
I think the fun ones I'll never forget when we had the Latin rock legends Maná come to the White House for Cinco de Mayo. And I was standing with them in the hallways of the West Wing. And, you know, Secret Service asked us to stand to the side, which usually meant one of the principals was coming through. And next thing we knew, here comes the VP. And he sees us kind of up against the wall. And he throws himself up against the wall. And he says, "Who's coming? Who is it? Who's coming?" You know, and it was just such a moment of like innocence and fun. And I looked at him and I said, "Sir, this is the bad Maná." And he goes, "I know. We were just at the party together." And I was like, of course you were. So, you know, those are the moments that will make me smile forever. Or interacting with the president, I was able to brief him before we went to Cuba in the Oval Office. And I'll never forget walking out of the Oval Office and I was standing with Cecilia Munoz, who's the head of the Domestic Policy Council. And I looked at her and I said, "Just a normal day at the office." And she looks at me and says, "Just take it in. Just take it in." And to get to know some of these people that the rest of the world perhaps only gets to see through TV or through newspapers has meant the world to me.
Did it feel like being in a movie?
Every day.
Really?
Well, you know, I still think it's crazy that I have gotten the opportunity to roam around the West Wing like I belong.
Belong. That sounds really significant.
Yeah. I think irrelevant of political party, this is the White House. To have a seat at the table of these conversations is really, really special. And there's a lot to keep fighting for, but at least we fought for so much and accomplished so much these past few years. And I'm just so grateful to have been part of this.
So what happens now for you?
Vacation. I'm really excited about it. I'm going to Hawaii. So I'm going to take a break and then perhaps a long nap. And we'll see what comes after that.
That was Gabriela Chokier, Senior Director of Hispanic Media at the White House. For many Latinos in the U.S., that changing of the guard at the White House fills them with fear. President-elect Donald Trump has spoken about deporting millions of people. So imagine the anxiety for members of an immigrant family that's split when it comes to legal status. That's the case with the Ramos family of Memphis, Tennessee. Some of them have legal documents, others don't. We have a story about them up at PRI.org. It's written by Daniel Connolly. He's been following the Ramos family for years.
The parents, Mario and Christina, are Mexican immigrants. The two oldest sons, Dennis and Isaias, were brought with their parents when they were young. And the third son, Dustin, was born in the U.S. He's a U.S. citizen.
So recently they made a decision to split up, right? What was that like?
Yeah, so this was in December of 2015, over a year ago now. Mario and Christina, the parents, voluntarily chose to go back to Mexico. And the two oldest sons, who are in their 20s, are taking care of Dustin, who's now 13.
And what was that scene like? Because it happened at a bus station, I think?
Right. So the way they arranged it was that Mario and Christina took a bus from Memphis to Dallas, and then they took a plane from Dallas to Mexico, a country they hadn't visited in around 13 years. And what I remember most about that day was the sons were very tense. What you have to understand is that for both sides of the family, it was pretty difficult to travel back and forth from Mexico. So they stood to be separated for a long time. And I just remember a lot of tension in the air. And, you know, for me personally, it was a very sad moment too, because I'd spent a lot of time with Mario and Christina and their family. And, you know, I personally felt sad to see them go. And I can only imagine what it was like for the sons to see their parents go.
And you basically watch the older brother, like, take on the weight of being a parent in front of you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's both Dennis and Isaias are in their 20s, and they're both now essentially running a household on their own and taking care of their younger brother who's in middle school. So it's a tremendous responsibility to do that. So they're handling work and looking after him much like a parent would.
So what did the parents tell you about why they decided to move back to Mexico? Why leave the children here?
A lot of Mexican immigrants that I've interviewed over the years had the intention of coming to the U.S., staying for a while, and then going back. And that was true for Mario and Cristina. And they always had this plan to go back eventually. In addition to that, they had a property, actually several properties, that they owned in Mexico, and they were hoping to sell those properties. They feared losing the properties. So they left in 2015, and at that time, Donald Trump was just a candidate, and they told me that their decision really had nothing to do with the political situation.
Did that surprise you?
No, because, I mean, they've always acted independently. And so the parents, at least, are not very political people, and so they made a decision that was really not a political decision.
So, Daniel, what's next for the Ramos family?
Well, the two older brothers, Dennis and Isaias, are concerned about losing their deferred action status, which is a temporary protected status they got under President Obama. The next president could end it. And, you know, more broadly, a lot of citizens, U.S. citizens like their younger brother, Dustin, are vulnerable as well. Whatever happens, children of immigrants are going to need support. It's important for people to contact elected officials at the school board level on up to the federal level to get the children of immigrants the support they need and to help some of the organizations that are working on this, like Excellencia in Education and the Hispanic Scholarship Fund.
Author and reporter Daniel Connolly telling us about the Ramos family. Thanks a lot, Daniel.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman. Some of the opioids fueling America's drug crisis are coming from China via regular mail delivery.
People should think about it like airport security. All the screening of foreign travelers is done before they get on the plane, because once they're here, it's impossible to stop it. We should do the same for the mail system.
More on that still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. This is not a normal time in America. A lot of people have been saying that since the election. But there's something that has nothing to do with Donald Trump and politics that's not normal about our country right now: the opioid epidemic. The numbers are staggering. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 91 Americans die every day from opioid overdoses. 91 every day. That could involve prescription drugs like oxycodone and fentanyl, or illegal drugs like heroin. Overall, the CDC says more than 500,000 people have died from a drug overdose since 2000. And the drugs Americans are abusing are only getting more powerful. Officials in Pennsylvania recently reported the first two overdose deaths in that state involving a synthetic opioid called carfentanil. It's believed to be coming into the U.S. from China. Carfentanil was originally developed as a sedative for big mammals like elephants. That gives you some idea of how bad things are getting. Erica Kienetz is a reporter for AP. She's based in Shanghai and has been reporting on China's role as a source for much of the fentanyl and other synthetic opioids that are contributing to overdose deaths in the U.S. and in Canada in recent months. So, Erica, you've been investigating fentanyl and its more potent cousin, carfentanil. As part of your reporting in China, you actually contacted some companies online and tried to buy some of these opioids. How easy was it?
It was very easy. I should say I didn't actually buy them, because that would really be illegal and quite hazardous. So I didn't actually buy them. Mm. We didn't actually test them, but we certainly got a lot of offers for many different opioids. We were focused initially particularly on carfentanil, because it's one of the strongest opioids in the fentanyl class of drugs, and it's been used in the past as a chemical weapon. And just looking on the open internet, I found over a dozen companies that were happy to offer carfentanil for sale. Sometimes they would guarantee delivery to major Western capitals. Some companies would offer advice on how to best sneak packages past customs.
So carfentanil, let's get into that. You said it can be used as a chemical weapon. What is carfentanil?
So carfentanil is an analog of fentanyl, so it's a very similar molecule that's about 100 times stronger. It was developed in the 1970s, and it has a legitimate use as a tranquilizer for large animals. If you look at the literature about carfentanil, you see all these reports about how, in scientific papers, about how to tranquilize moose and elephant. And then suddenly, in July of this year, you start seeing reports about carfentanil leading to drug overdoses in Canada and the United States.
So with carfentanil and fentanyl, how is it getting to the U.S.? What's the route it takes?
What the DEA says is that a lot of the analogs, so that would be carfentanil, acetylfentanyl, all this family of very similar compounds, are often coming from China by mail into the United States. DEA says that the other major route is through Mexico, where you have drug cartels, including the Sinaloa cartel, purchasing fentanyl and fentanyl analogs from China, processing them in Mexico, and then sending them north across the border along very established distribution lines. I should say that China, while it does acknowledge its role in this trade, has questioned those U.S. assertions that it is the main source of all of these compounds, simply because the U.S. has not provided any data to China to prove that it is in fact the main source country. Casework, investigations support that thesis, but there's not good statistics.
How much cooperation is there between the U.S. and China in trying to crack down on synthetic opioids? I mean, if they're just trying to get the data, it sounds like there's not much cooperation.
Well, I think they're two separate issues. So I think the lack of data is a function of the challenges that the rise of these chemicals in the narcotic supply chain have created. They're difficult to identify. So it's not like the field agents across America who are seizing these things have all of the equipment they need to identify these things on the spot. Separate from that is the issue of U.S.-China cooperation on narcotics. And I think that has been held up as a bright spot in an otherwise often fractious bilateral relationship. It's important to remember that these synthetic opioids are not widely abused within China. In October 2015, China banned 116 of these synthetic drugs that aren't abused in China that are abused in North America. And the DEA has praised that as a real positive step of cooperation.
If carfentanil is legal in China, what is it used for?
Well, carfentanil is a large animal tranquilizer, and it's just that China hasn't taken the bureaucratic steps to make it a controlled substance. So they started that process in October after intensive lobbying from the United States, from the State Department, from DEA, and that process takes up to 9 months.
Erica Kienetz is a reporter for AP in Shanghai. You can read more of her reporting on synthetic opioids at PRI.org. Erica, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
So a big part of the problem, as we just heard, is how synthetic opioids are getting into the country through the U.S. mail. Juliet Kayyem says this makes the opioid crisis a top national security issue as well. Kayyem is a former assistant secretary for Homeland Security in the Obama administration. She now teaches counterterrorism at Harvard.
Homeland Security has to be about risk reduction and about the vulnerabilities in our system. And while over the last 15 years we've, you know, tightened up airline security, cargo security, maritime security, we've done almost nothing with mail. And at some stage, the anecdotal evidence we're hearing about what is coming into this country, how it's killing American citizens, opiates, fentanyl, all of it, at some stage you have to look at the vulnerabilities in the system itself.
You said mail. So how is fentanyl, fentanyl, all this stuff coming into the U.S.?
It's, well, look, our mail is essentially not processed. Bulk mail goes through radiological devices. But ever since, even since 9/11 and the anthrax attacks, there is no sort of advanced electronic security screening system to see what is coming into this country. And so from abroad, stuff is literally being mailed in. And we know certainly from the death toll and how people are dying in this country, we know that it is being mailed from countries in particular like China and Russia.
Is the majority of opioids coming in through the mail?
You know, we don't know, and we're pretty cautious. Those of us who have gotten involved in this issue are pretty cautious about saying that the numbers aren't there. One of the reasons why we don't know is because of the gap in our mail screening process. We actually do not require advanced electronic data screening of mail. That would mean it is known before the package arrives who sent it, who's it going to, what's in it, what's its weight, what's the quantity of materials. Now, obviously, no one's going to put, I'm mailing it from this address, press and it has, you know, illegal drugs in it.
Right.
But it's only through advanced electronic screening that you can actually get trends, figure out neighborhoods in a country like China where there may be vulnerabilities. You can put addresses on essentially a no-screen list. Once it enters this country, it's essentially too late. So people should think about it like airport security. All the screening of foreign travelers is done before they get on the plane, because once they're here, it's impossible to stop it. We should do the same for the mail system.
So you're involved with a group, Juliet, called Americans for Securing All Packages. How far along are we with kind of being able to set up a system to track packages from China, from Mexico, from anywhere?
Well, so since 9/11, actually, there was a demand that the United States Postal Service look at its ability to advance screen data. That hasn't happened. Part of it is there was no congressional mandate. But certainly over the last 15 years, technology has gotten better. And I would say the vulnerabilities have gotten bigger, that this is something that the United States should require of its own services. The private sector does do it and is required to do it, so we know that the system can work.
So presumably dealers are not sending stuff through FedEx because you have to put your name
that's exactly right.
Address.
Right, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it has that advanced data. So they are not using that system. And if you go on the dark web, which is a place where all sorts of nefarious things happen, including terrorism and arms supply and counterfeit money and drug use, there are actually statements on the dark web that if you want to get drugs into the United States, do not use the private services.
Right.
Use the good old-fashioned United States Postal Service, which, you know, when you think about it, you know, our own system should be the least vulnerable. It's just one of the vagaries of the legislative mandate sort of required more of the private sector than the public sector.
Yeah, but the problem is coming, we believe, from China, from Mexico. So are they ready to set up, you know, screening? I mean, is that happening?
No, and it probably won't unless you get international cooperation. And so there are international bodies that control standards of security for the postal system. And if the United States begins to make overtures that it wants the standards raised, that is how you get the international community to move. But without us moving, no one else will. This is doable. The technology is not that hard. It's just trying to get enough momentum behind it.
Yeah, and goodwill with the countries we'd be talking to. So what kind of a position is Donald Trump in to deal with the problem? Because he's already got bad relations with Mexico, and he's not doing too well with China either.
Right. And interestingly enough, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump, more so than Hillary Clinton, picked up on this issue, the vulnerabilities of our mail system, and actually seemed to approve or applaud it. This will require, though, legislative demand by Congress. There's a proposed legislation, bipartisan. This is really an issue. I mean, you talk about a world that is so partisan right now. This, the fentanyl and the opiate crisis, is actually bipartisan. You do have bipartisan support for legislation that would require an onboarding of this technology. That's what is needed now. That's what people like me are doing to try to push this. Then you will need a sort of international commitment as well.
Juliet Kayyem is a former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security in the Obama administration. She teaches counterterrorism at Harvard and is involved with a group called Americans for Securing All Packages. Juliet, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
273 people were pardoned or had their sentences commuted yesterday by President Obama. One of them was Chelsea Manning, as we heard earlier. Another was Oscar Lopez Rivera. And news that his sentence was commuted sent people out into the streets to celebrate in Puerto Rico. Oscar Lopez Rivera was a member of a Puerto Rican nationalist group that carried out bombings and other crimes in the 1970s and 80s, all in an effort to gain independence for Puerto Rico. He was sentenced to 55 years in prison for his role. He served 35 of those years. Now that President Obama has commuted his sentence, he's due for release in May. One of those celebrating the news is Oscar Lopez Rivera's brother. I asked Jose Lopez to describe the moment when he heard the news.
Everybody broke out in jubilation. We were all ecstatic. It was an amazing moment of this historical, incredible news.
Right. Well, he has served 35 years already. Where is your brother in prison physically, and have you spoken with him yet?
I have not spoken to him. He's at Terre Haute, Indiana, which is the Federal Correctional Institute. I spoke to him last Sunday, and with my brother, it's very difficult to talk about anything that has to do with him. He's always trying to find out the latest on the family, the latest what's happening in Puerto Rico. My brother is an incredibly unselfish human being who has learned to live with an incredible sense of inner peace. So it's very difficult to even talk to him about the future plans that he has.
He is 74, and his lawyer says he wants to live in Puerto Rico, and people there really want him to come home. What do you think his release will mean to people in Puerto Rico?
Let me tell you, Oscar's release was a moment of jubilation. In Puerto Rico, there's an incredible excitement. And in Puerto Rico, Oscar's cause has united the entire Puerto Rican nation. In Puerto Rico, we are extremely divided politically in terms of the political status of the island. Yet, Oscar's cause brought everyone together. And I also think President Obama made really an incredibly brave decision. By releasing Oscar, he is beginning a process of reconciliation with the Puerto Rican people. The U.S. has controlled Puerto Rico since 1898. And this message of President Obama to the Puerto Rican people is a message that we need to enter into a serious process of resolving the colonial quagmire, which is Puerto Rico. So I believe this is an incredible moment.
As far as the bombing that your brother was tied to, he was not convicted of any direct role in it, but a conspiracy. And some still hold him responsible because of his ties to the ultra-nationalist group that carried it out. Do you think Oscar, though, will reach out in some way or have anything to say to the families of the victims?
Oscar has already sent messages that he obviously feels horrible, that he, in the name of the Puerto Rican people as a whole, obviously we feel that sense of loss. However, let me make it very, very clear. Oscar was never, ever tied to any of the bombings, and particularly to the bombing of Francis Tavern, which is what I think you're referencing, the attack of Francis Tavern in 1975.
Right.
Oscar had nothing to do with that. And even more importantly, if the U.S. government, the FBI, had an inkling of evidence to tie my brother to the bombings of Francis Tavern, he would have been given the death sentence. So I don't know where there's information that links my brother in any way, shape, or form to any of those incidences.
Oscar has served and survived 35 years in prison. Does he still have hope?
Of course he does. My brother was placed in solitary confinement without any human contact for 12 and a half years. And he told me the prison administration wanted to impose loneliness on me. I had to learn to live with solitude. And it began to dawn on me that my brother had learned to transform solitude into a human action, something that we seek in order to understand the world about us. And it's a lesson that I've learned from my brother on how to find inner peace in spite of all the adversities that one faces, like he was under for 12 and a half years.
Jose Lopez teaches Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois. He's been telling us about his brother, Puerto Rican nationalist Oscar Lopez Rivera, whose sentence has been commuted by President Obama. Jose Lopez, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Last May, the former president of the African nation of Chad was sentenced to life in prison. Hissène Habré was found guilty of crimes against humanity. They included rape, torture, and ordering the murder of an estimated 40,000 people. It was a landmark trial, the first time a court backed by the African Union convicted a former African leader. Habré is appealing his life sentence this month, and among those following this case are Habré's victims, people like a man Ashley Cleek recently met in New York City.
My name is Suleiman Gengem. I'm a survivor of torture. I have fought for human rights for many years.
For decades, in fact. Suleiman Genga is from Chad in Central Africa. In the 80s, he was tortured, locked up by Hissène Habré, the country's president then. Many called him a brutal dictator. Now that Abre's in jail, and even though he's fighting to get out, Genga says at last there's justice. Genga tells me his story in the Bronx. He lives on the 16th floor of a 21-story housing project with his wife and three kids. He's stylish, wearing a collared shirt and his signature fedora. It's Friday, and Genga's family is watching African soap operas. Their apartment is modest, but affordable. Paying rent hasn't always been easy. Since Genga moved to New York in 2005, there have been odd jobs, lost jobs, a failed deli. For a time, his family lived in a homeless shelter. Now, they have a living room. He shows me articles he's saved about himself in English, Spanish, and French. One article shows Genga in his house back in Chad, when Aubrey was in power. Genga was a normal guy, an accountant, a devout Christian. Then in 1988, he was arrested, swept up with other suspected enemies of the state. He was jailed for more than 2 years and never told why. It scarred him for life.
To be to prison is just to die, not to ever leave.
Genga and the others were kept in small rooms with bright lights on for stretches, then shut off. Total darkness. Women were raped, men disappeared. Eventually, Aubrey was overthrown. Genga was freed, but he made a pact with God.
If I am ever truly able to leave this prison, God will have preserved my life to give me this mission to fight for and find out the truth.
That was 26 years ago. Today, Genga is 68, and that pact with God, he made good on it. For years, he traveled through Chad detailing how hundreds of people had been tortured during Aubrey's rule. Genga and human rights lawyers demanded justice, a trial. But there was pushback. In Africa, where Aubrey had followers, and in France and the U.S., where he once had support. But in 2015, Genga got his day in court.
Bonjour, Suleiman Genga.
Bonjour.
A video of the trial shows Genga testifying against Aubrey. He shows things he made in prison, a fly swatter, a knife, a spoon. He talks about the intense heat in prison, how dead bodies were left in the cells. Aubrey is also in the courtroom, wearing a white robe and dark sunglasses. A court guard stares at Genga, in shock, maybe awe. Aubrey got life in prison. Genga says after the trial, when journalists interviewed him, he broke down.
I cried so loudly, and the only thing that came were tears. And I could only cry, and I couldn't express this joy. It was this terrible emotion.
It was a rare moment of justice in Africa. For Genga, it was the result of his life's work. Back in New York, Genga is unemployed. He has bad eyesight and an injured leg. But he has all this experience on bringing brutal leaders to justice, and he wants to share it.
Ça doit vraiment enseigner.
The law educates. It teaches people. And our trial was educational. It is so necessary that people learn this lesson and know why it happened.
Genga hopes to start a foundation to help people protect their rights in places like Africa, Latin America, and the U.S., he says. Presidents are elected to protect people, he warns, not control them.
Quand on a élu un président, il devient...
If there are people who become president and believe that they have become a god or something, I don't know really what they think, but they are human like you. They are here. They will finish and another president will be chosen.
The fight for human rights, Genga says, is never easy or over. For The World, Ashley Cleek, New York.
Next to Chad is Nigeria, which is where musician William Onyebor was from. Now, the international artists we've introduced you to on The World over the years are mostly ecstatic to get spotlighted for a new audience. Onyebor actually shunned the spotlight. We were never able to interview the Nigerian singer, songwriter, and innovator. He didn't travel a lot, stayed mostly in his home of Enugu in southeastern Nigeria. He was so private, some Nigerians didn't even believe William Onyebor actually existed. But he did. Today we learned that he has died in his sleep at home in Nigeria. Here's what we do know about Onyebor. He released a series of killer electronic funk albums between 1977 and 1985, sounds that now feel like they were years ahead of their time. 9 albums in total, all released by Onyebor himself through his personal pressing plant in Nigeria. Over time, these records would soar in value and get widely bootlegged until David Byrne's boutique record label, Luwaka Bob, struck a deal with Onyebor and released the music to a global audience a couple of years ago. That's how I and a lot of us got to know the music of William Onyebor.
I want to realize, man, the way I feel in me.
How do you feel?
I want to realize, women, the way I feel in me.
How do you feel?
William Onyebor never promoted his music, and by the time Luwaka Ba put the music out, he had become a born-again Christian. Onyebor turned his back on the music biz, partly why he wasn't interested in speaking with us. But one person he did speak to was Eric Wells. He's a label manager at Luwaka Ba. So in 2013, I spoke with Eric Wells about his one-week, somewhat bizarre visit with William Onyebor in Enugu.
Much of what we did was spend time together watching Christian television, Nigerian Christian television. This Nigerian prophet called T.B. Joshua. The town of Enugu is heavily evangelical, so everyone in this town is basically born-again Christian. And when you go around town, if you meet someone somewhere, also most likely ask you if you've been born again.
Given how little we know about William Onyebor, what do we do with this album of amazing music without that context?
I think you should just listen and enjoy and take time to listen. I mean, you'll feel that there's a kind of a rigid structure in a way, but then it's incredibly free.
Eric Wells of Luwaka Ba Records speaking about Nigerian musician William Onyebor. Onyebor died Monday at the age of 70. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Come on!
RI, Public Radio International.